Hello, I am Pete Real, a high school English and Spanish teacher, an avid reader, and an aspiring writer. Thank you for listening to the Chills at Will podcast, in which we explore the visceral beauty of literature and its connection to our culture, our history, and ourselves. Hello and welcome to episode 119 of the Chills at Will podcast. You are not seeing things. That is indeed the great Disha Filia across the screen from me. A little bit about her. Her debut short story collection, The Secret Lives of Church Ladies, if you're watching at home, it's over my right shoulder, won the 2021 Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction, the 2020-2021 Story Prize, and the 2020 LA Times Book Prize, the Art Seidenbaum Award for First Fiction, and was a finalist for the 2020 National Book Award for Fiction. The Secret Lives of Church Ladies focuses on Black women, sex, and the Black church, and is being adapted for television by HBO Max with Tessa Thompson executive producing. Disha is also a Kimbilio Fiction Fellow and will be the 2022-2023 John and Renee Grisham Writer in Residence at the University of Mississippi. Go Bulldogs. Bulldogs?
I don't know. I'm not there yet.
Okay. Oh, shoot. I didn't mean to put you on blast. Okay. The Bulldogs. Yeah, I think so. How are you today?
Pete, I am great. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Oh, man. It's so great to have you. And this might be one of the hardest questions I ask you all day. Was crab really $8 in 1984 in Florida?
I mean, that was the big crabs. So that was like, you were getting the giant ones. You could get smaller ones for like $6 a dozen, you know? But that was one of the fact-checking questions my editor got stuck on. She was like, I cannot find verification of this. Are you sure?
Oh my gosh. I was lucky to hear some of your earlier interviews and, you know, shout outs to your editor. Tell me her name again. I apologize.
Yes. Sarah Georgie at West Virginia University Press. She is incredible. And it was a fantastic experience working with her. And she, you know, she's the editor that writers dream of, and that she keeps your vision, she keeps the voices, but she makes it tighter and clearer and better.
Yes. Wow. That's what it's all about, right?
Yes.
You obviously came in with some incredible work. It wasn't like she, you know, she did it all. You had some incredible stories to come with. Were there 9 stories in the original? Where, you know, I know some of them were previously published.
When we submitted a partial manuscript to West Virginia, there were 6 stories.
Okay.
3 of them had been published previously. And so I got my book deal based on those 6 stories. Mm. And so then I needed to expand the collection to 35,000 words. There was one story that I decided wasn't as strong as the others. And I also wasn't interested enough in it to do the work of revising it. I had just lost interest. I didn't really see much potential for it. And so I had 5 stories and then wrote until I got to 35,000 words. And that was an additional 4 stories. Mm-hmm. But I'm happy to say that there's an exclusive edition of the UK version that Waterstones is carrying. They're the UK's biggest bookseller, and exclusively with them, you can get Church Ladies with that 10th story.
Ooh.
I did go back and revise it, and you know, for just for the UK edition, just for the Waterstones.
Oh shoot.
Yeah.
Nice. It's not like one of those back in the day, like the albums that was like the greatest hits, but you're like, I already have all the songs.
Yeah.
Right. You know,
when the book came out at that point, I guess 4 stories had been published, because there were 3 that had been previously published. And then there was a 4th one. How to Make Love to a Physicist was published as like a promotional, like right before the book came out, at Barrel House magazine.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah.
Is it a situation, you know, the idea of like, I mean, you're such a good writer. You have to be a perfectionist, I would think, in some ways. Do you even look at, let's say like the Barrel House one or just any of your publications? Mm-hmm. Do you even look at that sometimes? And nothing to do with the editor, nothing to do with you, say, man, I could have changed that word. I could have changed that phrase. Or is it like, it's done, it's done?
Yeah, you know, with Barrel House published what was in the book, right? Mm-hmm. So, okay. And I haven't looked back at the three stories that were previously published before the book came out. Mm-hmm. I mean, but there was not major editing anyway. So, right. But there are things that I go back and look at. Like I did a column for Literary Mama for 4 years. Mm. And, you know, I look at it in my editor hat and I'm just like, you know, marking it all up. Absolutely. But with the fiction, but the stories in the collection, I'm, you know, I'm happy with them as is. Eddie LaVert, when Eddie LaVert comes, is the one that, you know, it was the one I was least confident about. Mm. It was the hardest to write. And every now and then I still feel like, I don't know about the story.
I love it. So, oh man, I'll probably remember by the time we're done tonight, but I was just today on Twitter, I saw an article that reminded me so much of the Eddie LaVert one. Mm-hmm. It was about like an older family member connecting with the singer. Oh, I'll remember in a second because I think mm-hmm. it's totally reminded me of yours, which is obviously a great sign for your text that it's like reminding people of other things.
Yes.
Art that begets other art, right?
Yes, absolutely. Man.
Well, we'll talk about, and I almost stumbled over the word debut. Like, okay, you just knocked it out of the park in your debut collection. It's not fair. No. But I'd love to go back a little bit. What, you know, growing up in Jacksonville, Florida, and maybe other places, I'm not sure. What were you reading? What were you writing? Was it like a print-rich environment?
No, I totally grew up working class. And, but, you know, we were rich, you know, I was rich in the fact that my family nurtured my love of books. Mm. I don't remember, you know, being introduced to books, but my mother told me I started reading when I was 3. And the first book I remember is, there's a monster at the end of this book. You know, yeah. Lovable furry old Grover. And I told my mom that many years ago and she said, you don't remember the pigeon book? And I was like, no. And she was like, you made me read that book a million times. So, but I don't remember the pigeon book. So, you know, I was introduced to just the world of words early. I remember reading and I also remember Sesame Street and I was absolutely obsessed. And the library was a big part of my development. And so, summers when I was too young to stay home, which probably was up until I was like 9 or 10, because I was a latchkey kid, and, you know, things were different back then. But you know, younger, you know, 9 and younger, on the in the summer, I would go to work with my grandmother, and she worked in a building that was on the next block from the main branch of the public library.
Okay.
And it was a big deal to be able to walk there by myself. Mm-hmm. And I would spend the whole work day there. So while my grandmother was working, I would sit on the floor of the library and just read. Same with my mother and her friends going to the mall. I hated shopping, but she made me come with her. And but the deal was I could just sit on the floor of Walden Books. You remember Walden Books?
I remember Walden Books very well.
And I could read a whole book in the time it took them to shop on Saturday all day.
Yes.
So it was, you know, I don't remember you know, family members reading, but that was, that love of reading and books was cultivated in me and encouraged in me. And that certainly made a difference. Just, I can't remember a time I didn't read.
I love it. I love it. You cannot remember that time. The, you know, Walden Books, shout out to Walden Books. I, you know, that Christmas gift certificate or whatever, right?
Yes.
So you were putting in work. You were like doing like an 8 to 5 while grandma was at work. You were doing your own work. Man.
I read so many books. And so it was like I would read while I was there and then I'd leave with the stack.
Of course.
You know?
Of course, because you're never done. Was there a limit? Did they limit you to like, I don't know, 15 books? Do you remember that?
I don't remember the limit. I know in elementary school, we probably had a limit because that was the other thing. I would go, you know, the school library, you went once a week and check out books and bring them back. And I was also a library helper. And there was, you know, with the little the cards, you had to stick the card catalog cards in there, people checking them out. I, you know, anything to be around books. I absolutely love Judy Blume. You know, she's one of my favorite writers. And then as I got older, you know, I discovered James Baldwin as a teenager and would just read through his works, you know, year after year into my adulthood.
How, what did that do for your popularity to be the library help?
I kind of just tuned it out. You know, yeah. I don't remember getting any grief at school, yeah. But in the summertime, I wanted to play school, you know, which was having, you know, read and do all the school stuff in the summertime. And my friends were like, are you kidding? We got out of school. We don't want to pretend to be in school.
Yes.
So I was an only child. So, you know, if I was going to do that, I did it with my stuffed animals. Like I was the teacher and I would read to them and record my little stories on my tape recorder and do the, you remember the beep to turn the page when we had the headphones? I did all of that. I was obsessed and my friends thought I was weird.
I'm of course laughing with you. Definitely. I know it very well. And I'm so glad you mentioned Sesame Street. I mean, what a formative, just a beautiful show. I mean, you know, rest in peace to Luis, you know, who passed away recently. I mean, those were just incredible times and, you know, so great for learning and the way that, you know, there's like that one famous episode where they dealt with death.
Mr. Hooper.
Right. Mr. Hooper. I mean, it's just, you know, ahead of his time, which I know is a term that's overused. So speaking of like James Baldwin, right? Was he someone like, you know, people were like, he was ahead of his time. Is that fair to say? Or was like he was understanding what was going on at the time and, you know, the masses were not ready for it. I wonder how you kind of see his legacy.
Yeah. You know, I think that, you know, America collectively was not ready for James Baldwin, you know, as you know, as someone who was outspoken, someone who was unapologetically Black, who told the truth about this country. And then, you know, we also know that, you know, he was a gay man. And so, you know, even within, you know, and he was also very active in the civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we know that there were folks in that movement who were gay, who were closeted, you know, or, you know, whatever. There was still barriers there. And so I think that, you know, just thinking about his work in that context, that what I take away is that he wasn't waiting for somebody to give him permission.
Right.
He knew that the work, his writing was revolutionary. His writing was considered, you know, radical, but he continued to, you know, speak that truth to power. But then he was also still a product of, you know, this environment and this country. And so, you know, we also see footage of him with Nikki Giovanni, you know, and other women taking him to task around issues to do with gender. And, you know, because again, he, you know, we're all human. And so I just love that 360 view that we get of him, that, you know, he grappled with some of the same things that we're grappling with now, these intersections.
Right.
That, and you know, and that race is not, we can't flatten race and just look at race. You know, many of us have, as, you know, Du Bois said, you know, Black folks have double consciousness, you know, as Americans and as Black people. But then for those of us who are not men, you know, you could say we have triple consciousness.
Right.
And so, you know, unapologetic, not waiting for and asking for permission, you know, that I definitely took note of that in his work.
I mean, definitely intersectionality before the term was commonly used. Right. And man, what a singular person he was.
Mm-hmm.
Like you said,
I was sad because there was no internet in the 80s, you know, and so I had these dreams that one day I was going to meet James Baldwin. And I think I found out in like 1989 or 90 he had died. He died in 1987. And I was just devastated because I just knew that, you know, he was, you know, spent a lt of time in France, but I thought at some point I was going to go to New York. I was going to go to Harlem and somehow he was still going to be there. You know,
Oh my gosh. We were doing, I would love to put a different name to it. My junior English class, we're doing, you know, the American Dream, which, you know, so general, but some really interesting things. And I showed them the James Baldwin, one of his debates, quote unquote. And it was so classic because the guy he was debating was nice. He was a professor and he was nice. And he was, wait a minute. But it was this whole idea of like, I think of like Martin Luther King, like the Birmingham jail letter, right? You know, these nice people don't get things done.
Right.
Yeah. Right? Like looking for decorum, right? And, oh, wait a minute, you know, that, you know, and James Baldwin was just, my students and I were just like, whoa.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, his oratory skills are just like.
Right. Because what's at stake is, it's human lives, you know? And so there was an urgency there that being nice doesn't acknowledge.
Right. Well, thank you for that. I'm wondering what else you were reading as you know, kid, adolescent. I mean, what was really interesting you, thrilling you, challenging you?
I was reading a lot of inappropriate things in the process of working on an essay about this, but I had a next door neighbor, like, you know, in my house, I was the reader, you know, my mother did subscribe to Essence magazine. So, and there was a time when Essence, I think it was that used to publish fiction, short fiction. But, you know, I don't think they've done that for decades. But my next door neighbor, who was also my godmother, I would go to her house sometimes, and she had a bookshelf, which to me was the idea of like having a library in the house was like amazing to me. But she didn't have kid books. And so, and she never, you know, said anything to me like, you can't read this or whatever. She just sort of left me to my own devices. But even at a young age, I kind of knew like the really kind of salacious things, you know, to be thinking about it. So I would get a book and then like hide it under my shirt and then go in the bathroom and read it. And I read The Happy Hooker. I was elementary school. I read Portnoy's Complaint. Like,
I've heard things. Okay. Yeah.
And so my little mind was just blown. Like, I didn't have the context to understand. I know there were, you know, I understood anything to do with genitalia was, you know, was risque. Jackie Collins books, you know, she had a lot of Jackie Collins, and so I was introduced to those books way too early.
Well, if I ever run for president or something, the picture that might ruin me, well, it wouldn't ruin me, it might help me. There's a picture of me and Fabio at the LAX airport.
Oh my gosh.
So I don't know if you ever run.
He had the flowing locks.
Oh yeah. This was probably 10 years ago. He was probably at least 50. That's a good looking.
Oh, that's a weave. You know, he's got a weave. That's got to be a weave.
I don't know. You might be right. You're probably right. You're probably right. But I'm guessing maybe you read a couple of those Fabio type, you know, grocery store paperbacks. Right?
I had standards. Like,
Okay.
Jackie Collins, you know, okay. I mean, so, you know, the high end romance.
Yes. I got you.
But no, I don't know what it was. I was not interested in the romance. Sure. I was definitely interested in the salacious stuff. And I think that's because that's what I read early on. And even there's some, you know, some teen books, some YA books, you know, Judy Blume's Forever was scandalous and Wifey, which was not a YA book, but I was like, hey, it's Judy Blume, you know? And I remember hiding some of these books, you know, from my mother. I read Go Ask Alice, which was absolutely terrifying and probably helped me be scared straight. Like, you know, like, nope, I'm not trying any drugs ever.
Yeah, that'll do it.
Yeah. So, you know, as I read, you know, the books of the time, well.
Yeah. I think obviously it's part of growing up that you, even the salacious, you can see, wow, there's talent here. Like,
yeah,
you know, maybe at first it was like.
Right? Hold your interest, that grabs you, you know. Meanwhile, like, I was bored to tears by the things that we were reading in school.
Sure.
You know, I mean, we did read, I remember reading Richard Wright's Native Son and just being absolutely terrified by that. My 10th grade history teacher gave me a copy of the autobiography of Malcolm X. It was not part of our curriculum though. I don't know what he saw in me, but he gave it to me. He's a white man, white history teacher, and he was like, you should read this.
Wow.
Yeah.
What was it about that book, about other books in that, you know, late high school, early college that just really thrilled you? And, you know, kind of like that double idea of like, man, I could never do this. And also I want to do this.
Well, I didn't know at the time that I wanted to write. It did not, writing as a professional, as a thing I could do, didn't occur to me because I think it was as a first generation college student, I was thinking very practically. Mm-hmm. And writing, you know, to say I could be a writer was like me saying I could be Michael Jackson. It was just like in the stratosphere,
sure,
you know?
Sure.
The idea of going to college and like majoring in English or AFAM history, you know, none of that was on my radar because mm-hmm. even though I went to Yale and it's liberal arts, that concept was lost on me. I still, all I knew of college was that's how you get a job to make mm-hmm. a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And so I was very limited in my thinking. So it was like doctor, lawyer, you know, those kinds of things that were high profile careers that I had seen people do.
Uh-huh.
And for stability, for financial stability. And I didn't want to do any of that. And so I was like, business. Yeah. So, so you know, I decided to major in econ, which is not the same thing as business. I don't know. But, you know, but reading those books growing up, what the difference they made for me was that it showed me how big the world was beyond my immediate world. And it made me curious about the world beyond where I lived.
Right.
It made me want to travel. It made me want to continue learning and growing. And it just, and I think it kept me from playing small and and not dreaming big and dreaming and just saying, well, I need to see what's out there. You know, uh-huh. I didn't know exactly what it was going to be. Like business is so vague, but I knew that I wanted something more.
I love that, playing small. I love that.
Yeah.
I got to tread lightly here because I know there's the Yale Harvard rivalry. Is Yale like, is Yale like Skull and Bones and all those like secret societies?
Yeah, I was in a secret society.
Oh shoot! Well, we don't need to talk about it, right? I mean,
that's all I can say.
Okay, all right, fair enough. I'll edit that out. No, you know.
No, you can leave that part in.
Okay, that's funny. Okay, so yeah, in another interview I'd read that, you know, kind of what you're talking about here, where you didn't necessarily have to be like a doctor or lawyer, but it's like practical, make money.
Yeah.
And then you know you didn't necessarily go into writing full time right away. You obviously must have had signs though that you were really good at what you did. Was there, I mean, did you do like writing workshops? Was it all after college?
It was all after, not only after college, but I was a mother of a toddler. Like I was, you know, in my late 20s. I was probably like 29, 30 when I said, okay, I'm going to start writing, but it was more like a hobby, you know, it was something cerebral that I could do for myself. And because I was at home with a young child all day. And it was the time that I kind of carved out for myself. And I would write stories. I was trying to write, not stories, I was trying to write a novel. That was initially, that's what I was trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then within 5 years, I was getting divorced and needing to, you know, make a living. And I was like, I think I'm going to try and make a living at this. You know, I'm going to try and build a career because I found that, you know, writing went from providing an escape for me to just, couldn't imagine doing anything else.
Right. Well, you made a good decision. You made a great decision. I'm not the only one to tell you that, I'm sure. We'll get more into the book in just a minute for sure. Who are you reading now? I mean, I know that you're, again, your debut short story collection. I know you've got some incredible work still ahead of you.
Yeah.
Who is still challenging you? Who are you reading that, whether they're same as similar to you in genre or not, that's really keeping you going?
Gosh, Robert Jones Jr., author of The Prophets. You know, the things that Robert is doing, you know, his work is just inspired. I call it ancestor breed. He changed forever, I think, what we think of as the slavery narrative and turned that on its head. And writing with the lyricism of Toni Morrison, you know, there are lots of comparisons to Toni Morrison and James Baldwin, and those comparisons are well earned. You know, short story writers that I am just, you know, in awe of, Nafisa Thompson Spires, Maurice Ruffin, Nana Kwame Adegbenye, Nana Nkwedi, who had a debut come out, I want to say last year, Walking on Cowrie Shells. Let's see, I feel like I'm forgetting people, but there are just a lot of folks who are doing things with satire and with humor. Rian Amilcar Scott, Dantil W. Moniz, who is also from Jacksonville, where I'm
from. Really? And
her short story collection came out in 2021. It's called Milk, Blood, Heat. And like my stories, you know, set in the South, but hers are specifically set in our hometown of Jacksonville. And, you know, they're just really beautiful, resonant stories. Donnie Walton, who also came from Jacksonville, she and I went to, or grew up in Jacksonville. We went to the same high school, but we were years apart, so we didn't know each other. But she's the author of The Final Revival of Opal and Nev.
I was gonna say, did you go to the concerts together or anything?
No, and we had different, you know, interests because she was a music head way back in ways that I wasn't, but she was the girl that was going down to the beach to this club called Einstein's, you know, and I was a little more straight lace, you know, pop, whereas she was into, you know, all kinds of music, but I was more, you know, Prince, Michael Jackson, you know, New Edition.
Cannot go wrong there. Oh, very cool. Thank you for those. What, when you say that Robert Jones, he's redone the narrative, is it, how so?
So, you know, he doesn't freeze us in time. You know, a lot of times with the slavery narratives, there's some allusion to Africa and where we came from, you know, whereas that thread is continuous in his narrative, that there's not a moment when you're not aware that the people that he's writing about, you know, they just didn't land in slavery, you know? And so the voices we hear in the narrative, the voices of the ancestors, and part of the story takes place, you know, in Africa, and we, you know, and so, you know, that reminder is always there that we are a people with a history and roots, you know, brought in chains, enslaved in this country. And then further, he shows, and you know who else does this is Jabari Asim. He also has a book out now called Yonder. Both books show that they don't minimize the horror and the brutality of enslavement, but still the agency and the humanity of the people who were enslaved, the cleverness, the quiet rebellions, the bigger rebellions, the sensuality, desires. And so in the Prophets, Robert's book in particular, it's the story is centered on two young men who, you know, work in the fields, but they also take care of the animals and are alone in the barn, and they are lovers. And, you know, that's dangerous. Sure. And the person that actually ultimately betrays them is another enslaved person who is sort of the master's mouthpiece and, you know, and preaching the master's gospel to that community. And so I feel like previously, and not to, you know, to put down all slave narratives, but Robert's novel just has a level of complexity and showing the deep humanity and centering us. And there's no white saviors in this book. There's no redeeming the white people in this book. And I think that may be, you know, uncomfortable for some readers,
of course,
you know, but that's the reality.
Yeah. Wow. Thank you. So he very much makes them individuals, but you're saying that there is a connection. They didn't just show up there. They have connections to parts of Africa.
And fully human and desiring, having desires and having personalities and ways of being in community with each other, despite the horror of what's happening.
Right. Well, thank you for that explanation. As you've, you know, you didn't just hear overnight with church ladies. You have a book on co-parenting. You have personal essays, and you just had at least one short story that came out last couple of weeks. You know, varied interests. You worked in in a computer firm or banking or both?
I worked at a Fortune 200 bank in corporate communications.
Okay. So, you know, varied interests, varied styles of writing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what your work clearly does, like you just talked about with Robert Jones, is it's definitely an antidote to Eurocentrism, yes. Right? They're in the collection. There are, you know, there's no need for the white savior. There's no, I mean, it's, these are people who have their own interests and desires and all the above. You do a lot of what he just said, but with, you know, maybe more modern day. How did your experiences, like in the real world, which sounds so generic, but I guess how do they inform your writing overall? And then we'll kind of transition into the church lady.
Well, I'll be blunt. I mean, my career experiences have made me want to write because I don't want to work for people.
There you go.
So there's that. But, you know, just there's so much freedom. I mean, this is what I've always wanted, which is to quote unquote just write, you know, because most of the time, and I mean, I've been writing for 20 years and I've always had to, as most writers do, to do something else to make a living, because you're not making enough money from the writing alone to take care of yourself, much less a family. And so, you know, working in corporate communications, it was something, a job that I took, and I did it for 3 years for some stability. Shortly before, the book sold, and then not long after that, I left. Like, I literally just walked out in the middle of the day one day because of, you know, the politics and dynamics in that particular environment. And so, you know, it certainly has been a motivator for me to, like, I gotta figure out how this works so that I can have some stability, and it keeps perspective for me, right? Because while now, you know, I don't have the stability of a salary, you know, thankfully I can, you know, do speaking engagements and things like that. And so that can be, that comes with its own challenges, but in the back of my mind is, it's certainly better than what I was doing before, you know? So it's kind of like, you got to kill what you eat, but I will take this any day.
I don't know what I'm talking about here, but a lot of the great writers say, you know, get a good tax guy or girl, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I'm running into that now. So, now you reminded me.
Sorry. All right, moving on. Good stuff. There's my segue, not really, but The Secret Lives of Church Ladies. I asked you before we started recording about the cover.
Yeah.
And you know, I can only identify the book with the cover now. It's like, you know, someone's name
is iconic.
Right? It's iconic. It really is. But, you know, not just the cover, but I would love to know some of the seeds for the book, and that may go back 20 years or 25 or more, you know, more immediate, whatever you like, however you'd like to answer that.
Sure. I mean, the seeds for the book really go back to my childhood and being in church, but being raised by my mother and my grandmother who didn't go to church. Mm-hmm. And just sort of looking at all of these different women and trying to make sense of the church's teachings, which were very narrow and lots of binaries that didn't fit what I saw in real life. But, you know, I'm looking at all these women and trying to see, like, what's possible for me. And then there are all these rules. And then even as a child, I could see the double standards, you know, gender double standards. I could see the hypocrisy. I could see the judgment, you know, I heard the stories. And so, you know, I didn't know how to reconcile a lot of what I was seeing and hearing, you know, and wondering about these women and all these rules around sex. Did they like sex? Did they masturbate? You know, I was very curious about their lives. Of course, I wasn't going to ask. And you know, and what was possible for me. And so, you know, I quote unquote did everything right. You know, I didn't have children until I was married, and I married a man. I married, you know, heterosexually. And then there was still this current of dissatisfaction. And so when my youngest daughter, as I mentioned, was a toddler, I was kind of fueling the dissatisfaction, giving it to these characters who were the women that I had been so curious about growing up.
Yes.
And their voices were very strong. My grandmother's voice, and that's why there are four generations in the book.
Right.
Because I grew up in an intergenerational home and community, and it was just, you know, the voice of my grandmother and her friends and the things they talked about and the you know, the things that they talked about that I wasn't supposed to hear, and, you know, the way we celebrated and what we ate and, you know, heartbreak and all of those stories that I was privy to. I was in a conversation prior to our conversation with a bunch of Black women, and we were talking about the two big rules growing up. You know, children should be seen and not heard, and stay out of grown folks' business. And so I learned very early, if I was just quiet, they would forget I was there. And, you know, I got stories and I got perspectives and things that, again, they stayed with me. And once I became older, I could make sense of them, had my own life experiences, had my memories and nostalgia once I wasn't living there anymore. And, you know, you bring that together with imagination. You know, Toni Morrison said that imagination is rooted in memory. It's bound up in memory. I think that's the language she uses. And that's what it was like for me in writing these stories.
The British writer Tice Jin, she talks about being an under the table kid.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Like, you can hear some things when you're under the table, right? You can, like you said, you can, you're doing the right thing, but you got that ear cocked, you know, trying to check it out. Is, you know, one of the things that makes the book so great, the nine stories, is that, you know, it could easily have been like direct opposite, like evil people. They go to church, but when they go home, they're evil. It's not like that, right? It's not like they're living double lives, all of them, like totally opposites, right? Like you said, it's the hidden, you know, desires. I'm quoting you here from another interview. It was, quote, many women who grew up in church were taught to, quote, tamp down what felt good. So you have secrets, shame, fear. I escaped mostly unscathed, but I was interested in the women who didn't. How did they get free? Right?
Yeah.
Very well said. It must have been a pretty good writer who said that, you know. The epigraph for the book, for the collection, is, let it be known, I did not fall from grace, I leapt to freedom. Let me just drop that mic real quick. From the autobiography of Eve, right? Did the epigraph come first? Did it inform the stories? Was it at the end? You know, how's that connected?
Yeah, the epigraph is last. I, you know, once I had the collection done and I was getting ready to send it to the publisher, you know, I knew I needed an epigraph. And I wish that I could remember what I Googled, you know, because I'm sure it would be a great story, but I Googled something and it probably had to do with Eve and changing the narrative or something like that.
Are we talking biblical? Sorry to interrupt. We're talking biblical?
The biblical Eve. Okay, right. Yes. And so, because I wanted some, I remember that I wanted something that reflected the fact that these narratives were centering women from their perspective through their only our gaze, nobody else's gaze but ours. And so that's what that epigraph does. We look at the Eve story, which we've heard a million times told from the perspective of someone else, Adam, you know, blaming her, you know, and Eve being cursed. We, you know, that motherhood and womanhood is viewed as a curse. Eve being tempted by the snake, being fooled, all of this stuff where she is really marginalized and condemned in her own story. And so, you know, in my stories, the women are moved from the margins to the center. And that quote from Ansel Elgin's poem does the same thing. It reframes the narrative of Eve, moves her to the center, gives us her perspective, which is, this was not a fall, this was a leap. And a leap is more empowered. A leap is active, it's not passive.
Yes.
And I just thought that that perfectly encapsulated my view of the stories.
Okay. The second to last story is called Instructions for Married Christian Husbands. And it's instructions. It's very, you know, when you get here, you know, like the lover, when you get here, do this, do that. Right.
Yeah.
And we don't, am I right? We don't know much about the speaker. We don't necessarily need to.
Well, so I didn't know much about her when I started writing the story, but then when I got to the part where she's saying, you know, about me, here's what you need to know about me.
Yes.
There's a part where I wrote, I own a bakery and I make the best peach cobbler in town. And I had this aha moment. It's Olivia from Peach Cobbler, all grown up. And I did not plan that, but she, you know, she stuck around and there she was.
Right. Oh, I love that. I'd heard that on a previous interview, so I was already kind of ready for that. But yeah. I was like, oh, cool. I guess, I mean, right, there's not a lot of exposition normally necessarily right. about her.
Yeah.
But like you talk about, I mean, she is her own woman. Mm-hmm. She has very little, very few, if any, moral qualms, right?
Right.
And I mean, she's very much, she is her own person. And, mm-hmm. you know, the stereotypical man who would act like that, she's saying, I'm going to do that. The idea of, you know, the husband is the one who's cheating on his wife. Mm-hmm. He's the one who is Christian in name. And, you know, he's
yes.
with the Cub Scouts and the parish and the whole deal. Again, do you see that as like a moral failing on his part, or more like, hey, we need to be more inclusive? Not that we're going to condone adultery, but
right.
you know, is it more like, hey, we need more space to like allow people to be people and not this binary that you talked about earlier?
You know, it's like, I haven't really thought about his freedom in that. I think it's more the fact that she would be judged more harshly.
Of course.
And so, you know, that's what kind of concerns me is, uh-huh. you know, I think the reason that men can easily do, you know, do what the men she sleeps with can do is because, yes, they have a lot to lose and they have a lot at stake, mm-hmm. but we see how these things usually play out. There's forgiveness, oh, you yeah. know. The devil made me do it, and the devil was the woman, you know? Mm-hmm. And so, yes, he has a lot more at risk, and he's the one who's actually, you know, breaking his vows and cheating. Mm-hmm. But we know that the stakes are still not as high for him in some ways,
yes.
you know?
Right.
And so that was more, you know, what I'm wondering, what I'm curious about, that, you know, that's my curiosity. And also the, you know, I do mention the story starts with referencing to the wives, you know, and so really looking at the wives and, you know, how they have positioned themselves as the opposite of the narrator, you know, they are respectable women. And so it begs the question, you know, the women who are doing everything right, mm-hmm. why are these men cheating on them? Mm. You know, what is that about? Mm. So it's not to pit the women against each other, because I think that's too easy. And I think we do that too often.
Okay.
But to really look at how we tell women they're supposed to be and how do you keep a man? And again, if he were to get caught, you know, his wife should bear none of the shame. And yet there mm-hmm. would be these questions. Well, she must not have been satisfying him at home.
Uh-huh.
You know, right. that, so she's got to carry the stigma and the burden and the shame. And so would the woman he was cheating with, mm-hmm. but, you know, whereas all of it should be on him, but it, you know, in reality, that's not usually what happens, especially if he's a man that has status like pastor or something like that.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think of the male equivalent of homewrecker, and
right.
I don't think it exists, right?
Right.
And yeah, the idea of, I appreciate how you bring in, you know, the wives into the mix as well. I mean, you know, and ideas of victimhood and such. Am I mm-hmm. correct that probably Peach Cobbler is like the best known of the stories?
Yeah, when people tell me they have a favorite, right. it's usually that one.
And the longest one, I believe, is about 35 pages. Mm-hmm. And it's an incredible retrospective. You know, it's written from... There's a flashback of sorts. There are flashbacks. The opening line is, you must have patted yourself on the back for that one, right?
That's a fun one. I just read the translation of it in French. The French okay. edition of the book came out. And that was kind of fun because I know a little French. And so I was curious. When the books arrived, I turned directly to that page just to see how that line would read.
Yes. Can you quote the line verbatim? Or
sure. My mother made a peach cobbler so good, it made God himself cheat on his wife.
And that, of course, was the pastor, Troy Neely, right? Troy Neely?
Yes. Our young narrator thinks he's God because she's so young that she sees this man in the pulpit who talks about God and who thunders and when he speaks and she conflates the two.
Yes. And what a skill you have in that story to, you know, he's the same person. I mean, obviously people develop or devolve, but he's the same person. But, you know, with the narrator, she gets older, obviously. And for her to actually literally think he's God, to being, you know, 17, 18 and really understanding how things are in the world. The mom lived a tough life. Am I oversimplifying it to say that, you know, she'd had a tough life and it was kind of like, hey, you're going to have to learn the same way I did. She wasn't sweet.
Yeah.
Like her cobbler was, she was tough. And, you know, there's a lot there about crumbs and the crumbs of life. Mm-hmm. I wonder a little bit about the backstory of the mom, maybe just in your head. Yeah. Like, was it kind of like, I suffered, you're going to suffer too?
It was more not making her suffer, but thinking, as we often do as parents, sometimes the thing that we think is going to protect our kids is mm-hmm. actually not what they need from us.
Sure, sure.
And so I didn't tell myself like a particular backstory for her, other than I just knew that she clearly had not been mothered well, such that she didn't know how to love her child the way she needed to be loved.
Right.
And that she was somebody who I didn't want to demonize, you know, but I also realized too, we can't always control how people are going to receive the character. So even though I tried to add some things that made her a little more sympathetic, I hoped where, you know, she's been sleeping with the pastor for all these years. And she tells her daughter, like, how do you think I kept the lights on?
Yeah.
You know, again, not to justify, mm-hmm. but to just sort of show that sometimes these things aren't as black and white. And maybe these aren't choices we've ever had to make, or this isn't a choice we tell ourselves, I would never do that. I would do something else, anything else, you know, perhaps that's true. But here's a woman who, this is the choice she made, but I was more interested in, what are the implications for her daughter?
Yes.
You know, and Peach Cobbler got rejected more than any other story when I was trying to publish some of the individual stories. And when I did get a reason for the rejection, it was usually, we just don't understand this mother. You know, no mother would ever act that way. Well, I mean, mothers do terrible things, you know, so that's not true. But I wasn't interested in like doing a whole detour and backstory of her mother's past, of why she would be this way, because this was Olivia's story. And I wanted us as readers to experience her mother the way she did. And our mothers, our parents, are mysteries to us for the most part. Mm-hmm. Maybe when we're older, we might discover the why of, you know, why they did the things they did, but sometimes we don't.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah. That story, you know, works so well as from Olivia's point of view. I mean, it just, you know how it is, like you can't see it any differently. I've read it that way. And it just works so well. You know, she wants to be, quote, free of other people's secrets.
Yeah.
She has to keep that secret. She ends up going to tutor the son of the pastor. Yeah. And it's just like, oh my gosh, right? And she meets the mom, the wife, and she's nice and
love
she's sweet. She's lovely. You know, she's so emotive with her. And, you know, it's just like, oh. But there's, you know, definitely ideas of pleasing with Olivia throughout the stories, you know, pleasing God, pleasing mom, even pleasing the pastor, you know, who's coming over there every once in a while. It's like, kind of like, what are you doing? You're invading my home. But I wonder where the idea of pleasing others came through, like where you kind of, was that really like one of your aims, one of your goals to have that as a theme?
Yeah, I think that it was survival for her. You know, there's a part where she says, you know, when she becomes an adolescent and her body develops, that, you know, she does things with boys, but mostly because she just wants to be touched. And before she becomes an adolescent, she's longing for her mother's touch, you know? And so she's, you know, she wants to make her mother laugh the way the pastor can make her laugh. And she wants to make a peach cobbler as good as hers. And it's a matter of just wanting the connection and wanting to be loved. Mm-hmm. And so people pleasing is what she knows to try to do. Yeah. And then, as she gets older and she's put in that awful situation where she, you know, has to go tutor this, her mother's lover's son, you know, or mother's married lover's son at his home with his wife, you know, she's resentful.
Of course.
She's resentful of her mother. She resents the pastor. She feels guilty in front of this wife, even though, you know, it's not her fault. But then, you know, she becomes attracted to the son, you know, and again, she's just trying to get her needs met.
Mm.
And yes. I think as we see her later, and again, I didn't plan it, but it makes sense. We see her later in instructions.
Mm-hmm.
She's the opposite of a people pleaser. She's making the rules, you know?
Yes.
And I think that was her attempt to control things. So it's mm-hmm. like, I'm going to make this, you know, I'm going to have some agency here. I couldn't control my circumstances before, but I can control them now.
Yes. You talked about Eddie Levert's story having maybe some trouble, or I just really enjoyed that story so much, or appreciated, loved all the above. So I got to tell you, I was by myself reading. I probably went like, woo, because that was because you did. I'm forgetting the song. My wife's going to
Forever Mine.
Forever Mine was one of the three was part of the medley for our wedding.
Oh, it's one of my favorite songs ever.
Oh, man. I don't know if you ever seen that, the Steve Harvey bit where he talks about back in the day, they used to have the one mic.
Right? No, I haven't seen that.
So, you know, so I was watching the video for that after reading the story, and, you know, back in the day, it'd be like, they'd all be singing, they do the spin and like come back to one mic.
Yep.
Right. You compare that to nowadays, everyone's got their own mic, but anyways, but you know, it's mama and his daughter, like, as if that's their given names. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, is it safe? She has dementia. There was a specific name given, right?
Yeah, she has Alzheimer's. Oh no, there's a specific kind of dementia. I forget. Yeah. I looked that up and I can't remember it now.
I gotcha. But you know, there's just something that's so sad and just moving about dementia. And it sounds like mm-hmm. they clearly had their troubles, mama and daughter. Yeah. And one of the quotes that was so well done was, quote, "The zeal of the newly converted is bewildering to the children of the newly converted."
Mm-hmm.
Right. So mama back in the day kind of had a change of heart, wanted to, you know, get more straight, get with God, that kind of thing. But just like, okay, mom hurt daughter big time,
mm-hmm.
but that's your mom. That's her mom. She's older. She has needs. Quote, who had ever loved mama besides her children?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right. And I'm totally cribbing here from Kiese. How do you say it? Layman.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Kiese.
Who is a literary heavy, pardon the pun, with his great book, right? Who is an incredible writer, great interview, and just a conversation with you. But he talked about revelation versus resolution.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. And that, when I heard that, I just read so many of these stories differently.
Mm-hmm.
In the end of Eddie Levert is Coming, the daughter says to her mom, kind of like, mom's kind of like, who am I? You're... Mm-hmm. Ellipses, you're someone who can't give me what I want, but you're not a nobody, right? And this idea of the voices, both getting their voices and strong and certain. Yeah. And, you know, again, it wasn't tied up neatly. I'm sure they'll have their issues. It wasn't a happy ending, but there was clearly a revelation, right?
Yeah.
So I wonder about the Eddie Levert, like, that's a very specific singer.
Yeah.
I wonder the inspiration for that story and maybe those characters.
Yeah, so that story was all tangled up with my mother, my grandmother, and my great-grandmother.
Okay.
Eddie Levert, the OJs, was my mother's favorite group, hands down. So growing up, they were my favorite group, you know. I love the OJs because my mother loved the OJs. My mother and my grandmother had a very complicated relationship, but they lived together my mother's entire life. My grandmother died first, but when my mother moved out with, you know, left the house that we had been in for four generations at that point, I think four generations, five generations in that house. And then when my mother moved out at 49, she took my grandmother with her. And so they were all enmeshed. My great grandmother left my grandmother as an infant with her father's family, her grandparents on that side. And then she came back at some point when my mother and her siblings were older. And my grandmother ended up taking care of her. And it was my great grandmother who had Alzheimer's. And so they, my mother and my grandmother were both taking care of mothers who hadn't taken care of them the way that yes. they needed them to.
Yes.
And they had these very complicated relationships, and I never asked, but they never complained and said, I can't believe, you know, you treated me this way, but now I'm taking care of you. I never heard them say that. Mm. So I was very curious about what that might be like.
Right.
And so I imagined, you know, a dynamic between a mother and daughter where the mother had not been the kind of mother that her daughter needed. Mm. The daughter kind of doesn't have her own personhood. She doesn't even have, you know, people don't even call her by her name.
Yes.
But then, you know, she's tasked with taking care of her mother at the end of her life.
Hmm.
And I just, you know, I was busy off in college and living my life, so I didn't give it much thought when it was happening.
Right.
But I thought a lot about it as friends of mine, because my mother passed away, and friends of mine are doing that thing now where they're raising their kids and taking care of their parents. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And things, if they didn't get reconciled before they turned elderly or got dementia, it's like, you're kind of stuck now.
Yes.
So yes. I just thought that was an interesting place to explore.
Mm. You were talking about like not being mothered or not being mothered correctly, or, you know, whatever correctly means. But so there's the, what is it called? Letter to Sister?
Oh, Dear Sister.
Dear Sister, excuse me.
Yeah.
And it's a letter, that great last line I know that you've talked about before, right? But it's a letter upon the death of this shared father, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he was a father who was not a great father in the textbook right. sense, right? He,
yeah.
he was all over the place, had a lot of different, you know, mothers, and treated some kids well or better than others. And
relatively, yeah.
Relative, right, exactly. It's all relative, right? And I just, you talk about the different generations, and there's so many cool characters in that story. So many stories in this could be their own series or episode. Mm-hmm. I feel like this could be, you know, maybe Tessa Thompson's going to do one with just this one, because it's like so many cool characters. But the line that really got me, quote, is it better to have that one big hurt of your father not being around and not all those little hurts that come when he disappoints you?
Yeah.
Or is it better to have a piece of father hurts and all, right? So there's Renee, great character, prim and proper, and she doesn't cuss, right? And then there's Tashita, right?
Yeah.
Who's got a great heart, but she's not Renee, right? They have some back and forth. Shoot, I think they even got Renee to say a cuss word or something, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, because when it comes down to it, sisterhood trumps everything.
Yes. But that's what it was, right? I mean, they clearly had their disagreements. And but the way you did it as a letter, I'm like, man, she's dragging us out for a whole story, like in a positive way. Like, wow. I think there's even a part where like the letter writer, and tell me, sorry, what is her name?
Nichelle.
Right. Where she even like, hey, I'm gonna go eat dinner real quick. And it's like smooth, and it's like, whoa, and you pulled it off. It's such an expansive story in some ways, right? There's so many different characters represented. How did you make it coherent?
So, you know, it's funny, you know, when you publish a book, even fiction, with University Press, you have two peer reviewers, and, you know, there's the infamous reader too, you know, that
okay.
makes it, you know, makes a recommendation of whether or not the book should be published. And reader two took issue with Dear Sister, and they were like, this isn't a real letter. Nobody would go on this long. And I pushed back, and I was like, you know, the epistolary form is an old form, and, you know, it absolutely kind of suspends disbelief, and, you know, I think this works. And my hope was that people would be so caught up in the story that no one would be like, this isn't really a letter, nobody would do this, because of course nobody would do that in a letter, but, you know, work with me here. And so yeah, I'm glad I was allowed to have take those liberties with
that. Must have been fun. That must have been fun, right?
Yeah.
Oh man, we could talk for hours and hours and hours. I just, you know, each story could be its own episode. I'm not, I really mean that.
Oh, thank you so much.
I just wanted to talk really quick about, is it pronounced Eula? So that's the beginning story, right?
Yeah.
It's around Y2K, right? Which we, a lot of us remember, right? And we have this, I say couple, right? They've been friends for many, many years. And Caroletta's the narrator. Eula is church going. She's patient. she's quoted as, you know, waiting for her Boaz, right? The biblical, yes. Mm-hmm. You know, a true believer. She goes to church. She has regrets at times, right? Mm-hmm. And she's in a you know, in a same-sex relationship, but she's her own person. There's not necessarily the guilt that you might associate. But Eula is kind of shocked by the ideas of purity from Caroletta. But here's the quote that really, again, is really so interesting. Quote, "You're not who I thought you were. You're not who you thought you were either."
Mm-hmm.
Right? Mm-hmm. I wonder how you position that relationship. It's a friendship. They're lovers. Sure. One is agnostic / not religious. One is still religious.
While teaching Sunday school.
While teaching Sunday school, right. How did you reconcile is not the word, because these are not, you know, opposing or one's bad and one's good, yeah. But how did you connect those?
Yeah, with those two, what I started thinking about was, you know, again, back those binaries, right? You know, you're not supposed to be a good Christian woman, you're not supposed to have sex outside of marriage. You're supposed to wait. And you're expected to be pure and chaste, meaning, you know, no sexual activity while you are waiting. And I remember having a conversation with a friend sometime before the story came out, and he was lamenting the trend of all these girls saying they're bisexual or they're, you know, and he was doing that. So back in our day,
came out of nowhere,
you know,
right?
None of this stuff was happening. And I said to him, how do you know? So how would you know? And he had to say, touche, because he wasn't at slumber parties. He wasn't with girls when boys weren't around, which was a lot of the time. He had no idea what girls did. I said, the only thing you know about what girls did is what we told you we did, you know? And he had to kind of take that. And so it got me to thinking about the fact that when we tell women, Christian women, you know, you have to be careful. You can barely date. There's no dating. There's courting, you know, and there are all these rules about not being tempted. So there's this separateness, there's this segregation based on gender, but we all know that people have urges and needs and hormones. So if you're spending most of your time with other women, something's bound to happen. Right. And I think it explodes these notions that we have around labels around sexuality, because I think even Caroletta, who, as you point out, is, you know, more liberal and more open to than Eula is, even if it's secretly, I don't even know if she would call herself gay.
Right.
You know, I don't know if the labels that so many of us so easily, you know, take on and put on and take off would fit for her. What Caroletta knows is that she loves Eula.
Yes.
She absolutely loves Eula. And they kind of fell into each other's arms, bodies, you know, one drunken night, and then just kept it going. But one night a year, just one night a year.
Yes.
And that is also something else that, you know, I think that something unhealthy that the church, the evangelical church, sometimes fosters is this idea of, you know, just sort of skirting it. You know, we can do this thing, but we got to pray about it and ask for forgiveness before we do it. You know, I remember in college, there were religious couples that would have sex either before or after, I mean, pray either before or after they had sex outside of marriage. You know, so these weird things that the church would have people doing. And so I think that was what Eula and Caroletta did, which was, well, we're only doing this once a year. You know, that's sort of the
I see.
The deal they strike, you know,
story
that they tell themselves to, you know, at least Eula, to make it okay. Yes. And so in a way, it sort of infantilizes people, these kinds of rules and restrictions that don't honor us as fully human people with a range of needs, including sexual needs and desires that are just perfectly normal. When we literally demonize those things, you know, people do all sorts of things to try and get their needs met.
But wait, I mean, there was no sex in the Bible, right?
Yeah.
So speaking of biblical, Jael.
Yes. Jael,
she had no such qualms about being open about her business. And what a great what a great, I don't know, maybe juxtaposition is not the word, but you have the two narrators of that story, mm-hmm. she and her grandma, right?
Great grandma,
excuse me.
Yeah.
And, you know, this idea of like traumas through generations mm-hmm. and the grandma, the great grandma really trying to like, you know, like you talk about really, you know, kind of rein her in like, hey, wait a minute, you're out there doing these things. What a great story. I could see it being like a thriller mm-hmm. without giving away too much. Like in reading that story, am I going to get called to like a court case? Like does Jael, you know, you can say as much as you want about that, but that, the way that you set up, is it Jamie?
Yeah.
Right. The way you set him up is as not like overly sleazy, but sleazy enough.
Yeah.
And just the way that ending, I was like, whoa, I got to read. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. But you know, just the idea of like those people that are kind of like self-appointed to help, right?
Yes.
To help the wayward girl, to help the wayward boy. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, you got like a thriller in you or a mystery book, book too, because that one was really well done.
Thank you.
I love Snowfall. I don't live in an area where it snows, but I can imagine. I just look at these people. I'm like, why would you? Right. You were saying maybe that was one where you would do a reading from it.
It's
totally up to you.
So, you know, I'm going to read an excerpt from the middle, and all folks need to know to get into this is that the narrator is referring to we. She mm-hmm. is a woman named Arlita. She's referring to herself and her girlfriend, her partner, Rhonda. And they have moved to a very cold place, and they don't like the cold, like me. We were born and raised in warmer places, Georgia and Florida. Warmer too in the residual charm, polite smiles, and gentility of the white people whose ancestors owned ours. In the South, the weather does not force tears from your eyes, causing the faces of passing strangers to register worry about you for a millisecond. It's the wind you want to tell them, but a millisecond is not enough time. In the South, the weather does not hurt you down to your bones or force you to wake up a half an hour early to remedy what has been done to your steps, your sidewalk, your driveway, and your car as you slept. But the South has hurricanes, they say. Yes, but not damn near daily, not for a full quarter of the year. You tell people up here that you're from the South, and 9 times out of 10, they say the same old thing. I'm sure you miss the sunshine. Rhonda and I both miss taking sunshine and easy morning commutes for granted. But what we really miss are the laughter and embrace of our mothers and grandmothers and aunties, kin and not kin. We miss the big oak tables in their dining rooms where, as kids in the 70s and 80s, we ate bowl after bowl of their banana pudding and talked to each other about how much weight you gained, like you weren't even there. We miss helping them snap green beans and shell peas, sitting at their kitchen tables, watching The Young and the Restless on the TV perched on the pass-through. We miss how they loved Victor Newman, hated Jill Foster, and envied Miss Chancellor, and how she dripped diamonds and chandeliers. We miss their bare brown arms reaching to hang clothes on the line with wooden pins. We miss their sun tea, brewed all day in big jars on the picnic table in the backyard, and later loaded with sugar and sipped over plates of their fried chicken in the early evening. We miss lying next to them at night in their four-poster beds with two soft mattresses covered by iron sheets and 3-generation-old blankets. We miss their house coats perfumed with absorbing junior liniment and hints of the white shoulders they'd spritzed on from an atomizer that morning before church. We miss tracing the soft folds in their skin when we held hands and watched our favorite TV shows in their beds, Dallas, Dynasty, Knott's Landing, and Falcon Crest. We miss how they laughed and were easy with each other, how their friendships lasted lifetimes, outlasting wayward husbands and ungrateful children, outlasted that time Alma caught Joe cheating and she whacked him on the top of the head with a sword he brought back from the war, but he told the people at the hospital he didn't know who did it. Outlasted having to hide your medicine bottles in your shoes because otherwise 7 of your 9 children were liable to steal them. We miss how they seem to judge everyone but themselves. Or maybe that judgment was in the nerve pills they procured from the Chinese doctor on Bay Street who didn't ask questions. We miss their furtive cups of brown liquor on Friday and unabashed cries for Jesus come Sunday. We miss their one gold tooth that made us wonder who they had been as young women. We miss their blue crabs, the shells boiled to a blood red and washed up tubs atop bricks over makeshift fires built in the yard. The wash tubs reminded us of cauldrons full of rock salt and cayenne drenched water, bubbling and rolling, mesh bags of seasonings and halved onions and peppers floating on top, along with potatoes and ears of corn. We miss how they stood over those cauldrons like witches stirring a potion, with sweat beading on the tips of their noses and smoke swirling around their hands and wrists. They wielded long-handled spoons to press the frantic flailing crabs toward their deaths. We miss how they made our Easter dresses and pound cakes and a way out of no way. But we lost all those things when we chose each other. Only the memories remain, which is why, even though we grew up in different places, so many of our bedtime conversations start with, "Remember when?" As we lie there in the dark with our nostalgia and nothing to distract us from it, not even each other, not anymore.
Thank you. That litany of "we miss," I mean, there's something with nostalgia and "we miss" and, you know, the idea of them not judging and mm-hmm. the soft folds and just the "we miss," and it just continues to build and build and build. And then there's that, "but we gave it all up," right? Oh man. Thank you so much for sharing that beautiful part of Snowfall.
Thank you.
So future projects, I know that the collection is going to a series, or I want to know, like, are we talking like Justin Bieber Peaches? Are we talking 112 Peaches and Cream? Like, do we have a theme song yet? Is there a none of the above?
So far, no theme song.
Okay.
But I am currently working with my co-writer, Tori Sampson. We are working on the pilot. We'll be executive producing also, along with Tessa Thompson for HBO Max.
All right.
And we're sort of building a world right now, a single world, and pulling characters from the different stories and bringing them together in some interesting ways.
Oh, that's so cool. Is it something where you have to pick stories, or do you feel like there's parts of...
it's like a palette, having the book as a palette and creating and making something beautiful from the range of stories and characters we have to play with.
Oh, congratulations. I mean, that's going to be look so great on the screen. That's going to be so cool.
Thank you.
Oh man. It's been such a pleasure. I know you're probably, you know, zoomed out and you've had all kinds of Zooms and you had some in-person a few weeks. I just appreciate so much your time and your generosity of spirit as well. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Pete. This has been great. Thank you.
I've enjoyed the heck out of it. And again, continued great luck with your work.
Thanks.
What a pleasure it's been to speak with Disha Filya. Continued good luck to her with her writing. And I'm so looking forward to following her career. You can now subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts and please leave a 5-star review. You can also ask for it by name using Alexa, find it on Stitcher, Spotify, and on Amazon Music, but let's not patronize those last two. Follow me on Instagram, where I'm at Chills at Will Podcast, or on Twitter, where I'm at Chills at Will PO1. Disha, I'm so sorry. What is your contact info? Pretty easy to find you on social media.
Yeah, I'm at my name everywhere, DishaFilia.com and at Disha Filia.
You said everywhere, including TikTok?
Okay, not TikTok. Darn it.
yet. Okay.
I'm holding out.
You can watch this and other episodes on the Chills of Will podcast YouTube channel. This is a passion project of mine, a DIY operation, and I love for your help in promoting what I'm convinced is a unique and spirited look at an often ignored art form. The intro song for the Chills of Will podcast is Wind Down Instrumental, and the other song played on the episode was Hoops Instrumental by Matt Whitehour. Both songs are used through archesaudio.com. Please tune in for episode 120 with Tracy Kato Kiriyama, a multidisciplinary artist, writer, author, actor, arts educator, and community organizer. They have most recently released their book, Navigating With/Without Instruments. Since 1996, Tracy has performed and written for theater, tours, productions, artist residencies, and performance collaborations in hundreds of venues throughout the country. For now, thanks again for listening. And I hope that these quarantine days bring you texts from writers with mad skills like Disha Filia, whose The Secret Lives of Church Ladies give you chills at will.